Despite the fiery conflict playing out between the gay community and the church, there wasn't always a neat divide. That is, there were lots of gay Catholics still very much inside the church, or at least trying to find a place for themselves. That's something David grappled with. He was still angry at the Catholic Church, but the AIDS epidemic was raging, and he felt he needed spiritual support. He went to a friend, a priest in the Episcopal Church, another Christian denomination, for advice.
And I remember very specifically, he looked at me and he said, "David, I can't recommend an Episcopal parish to you. You're hopelessly Catholic."
David's friend told him to go back to St. Francis Xavier, the same church that Dignity had been kicked out of back when David walked away from the church. Going back to that space to worship was an emotional challenge for him. So he hid at the back of the church, sitting near the doors, in case he felt he needed to leave.
So, 2 weeks later, on a very hot Sunday in August, I walk in for Mass, and I sit in the back of the last pew in the church, ready to bolt at the first homophobic thing I heard coming from the pulpit. And at the end of the Mass, I was in tears. Because I felt I had found a place where I could be who I was. I could offer all the gifts that I had been given, and I could be an active participant in that faith community.
When I visited David's church, I was struck by its grand scale. Elaborate paintings of the Stations of the Cross, its colorful antique Tiffany window. But one of David's favorite details about his parish is at the front of the church. When the church was restored almost a decade ago, the kneelers were taken off the pews and fashioned into the altar. The kneelers on which David prayed when Bill was dying, when he grappled with his own HIV diagnosis, when he lost dozens of friends, those kneelers are now the centerpiece of the church.
And so now all those years of people's prayers is congregated in the altar.
The story of AIDS in the United States cannot be separated from the Catholic Church. As David told us, the first meeting of gay men's health crisis actually took place inside a Catholic church. Many ACT UP members were raised Catholic, and there were lots of priests and nuns who put their own vocations on the line to minister to gay men and their partners. Catholic hospitals around the country were among the first to offer treatment to people with AIDS. This is all to say, there's a lot to learn from this time period. Nearly three decades later, we risk losing these stories if we don't capture them now. That's what I'm aiming to do with this podcast. I want to share the stories from the height of the AIDS crisis, both those that inspire and those that infuriate, so we can remember what happens when society turns its back on those in need.
That was a story from the new podcast Plague by Michael O'Loughlin.
Welcome to Tabardin, y'all, a weekly podcast about the stories we tell and the events we discuss while on pilgrimage as queer Catholics. I'm Pat Gothman, the pink candle in your Advent wreath. I was raised Catholic, but I've only been out for a few years and I'm trying to figure out exactly how to be a gay Catholic still.
The pink candle, huh?
That's me. You got a couple more weeks before I get to be lit.
I can't wait. All right, and I'm his fiancé, Jacob Flores. I'm a recent Catholic convert.
And I was raised gay. Just kidding.
You were raised gay.
I used to hang out in the magazine section of Borders Books, rest in peace, pretending to read City of God by Augustine.
Did you really?
Yeah, but I was actually looking at fashion magazines with okay. all the male models.
Fair. Yeah, weren't we all?
So, Pat, what do we've got on the podcast this week?
This week, we got to talk to Michael O'Loughlin about his brand new podcast. Michael J. O'Loughlin is a journalist, author, commentator, and speaker who covers religion and politics with a particular focus on the Catholic Church. And he is the host of America Media's newest podcast, Plague, Untold Stories of AIDS and the Catholic Church, out now wherever you get your podcasts. We got to talk to him about some of the incredible stories he heard from folks who were on the ground during the AIDS crisis and everyone from AIDS activists to church members who were ministering to AIDS patients.
So I was driving home from Thanksgiving at your folks right. this past weekend, from Dallas to Austin, about a 4-hour drive. I listened to the podcast and I actually had to pull over because there were points where I was just like, this is too deep.
Yeah.
It's I had to take it in.
Parts that are heavy, right?
Yeah. But super, super important stuff to know and to learn. And I'm really thankful for this endeavor.
Yeah, and it was great to talk to Michael about a lot of kind of what went into this podcast, the stories about why he even wanted to tackle this topic, and just how many people were involved in both some of the good stuff and some of the bad stuff about how the Catholic Church responded to the AIDS crisis. So without further ado, here is Michael O'Loughlin. Well, Michael O'Loughlin, welcome to Tabard Inn. We are so grateful to be able to talk to you about this incredibly moving podcast that you've done.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, so jumping in. So, Michael, I know you've been working on this for a few years, but I'm interested in how you got to this point of wanting to tell the story about the AIDS crisis and the church's role in it.
Yeah, it's a good question. It has been a long project, and it's exciting to see it here. And just the response, people find the story so meaningful and consoling, especially LGBT Catholics, which is part of the reason I wanted to do this project. Because I've been covering the church now for about a decade. And a big part of that over the last few years, especially, has been how LGBT Catholics are trying to find a home in the church, trying to, you know, make a place for themselves. And a lot of that's kind of painful reporting, talking to other gay Catholics who have maybe been fired from teaching jobs after their marriages go public, or trans Catholics who can't find a place in a parish where they feel welcome. Church musicians who are let go after they come out. And it's not always the most uplifting things, but they are important stories to tell. And as I began thinking about what it means to be a gay Catholic today, I thought, I really don't know a lot of the history about how LGBT people fit into the church. And I was having dinner one night with a priest friend who he's active in LGBT ministry, just a good guy. And I asked him how he got involved. And he's in his 50s, and he told me that he actually started getting involved back in the 80s when he was a campus chaplain. The HIV epidemic was beginning to kind of take hold in big cities, and he noticed a number of people on campus were affected personally by what was going on, so he started a support group. It was, he said, a couple dozen guys met each week in the church basement, and he said it was a good program because of providing some comfort to people during a difficult time. But he was actually dragged into the bishop's office, and the bishop was very upset because he said, you know, what you're doing makes it look like the church supports homosexuality and we can't have that. You have to shut down the group. Well, my friend, he was a young priest at the time, just starting off his career, and he kind of stood firm and said, no, absolutely not. People are dying. People are dying by suicide because they feel hopeless and they have nowhere to turn, and we're providing a ministry that provides life. And he kind of dug in, and the bishop relented, and he kept the ministry going for a while. And I was just so moved by that story, and I thought, there's no way this is the only one. So I started looking through archives. I started kind of just Googling around Catholic AIDS ministry and just reached out to people and said, you know, can you share your stories with me? So for the past few years, it's been talking to people in their, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s who were working on the front lines back then, and just learning this whole new chapter about the church's history in this country, and especially about LGBT people who lived during this really difficult time.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's got to be tough. Do you feel like there was a lot of emotional labor after going through years of studying and researching?
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy topic, right? It's a mm-hmm. heavy stories. And I would say, you know, it was difficult for me, but it was nothing compared to what the people I interviewed went through.
Yeah.
I just got back a few weeks ago in November. I was in San Francisco reporting for one of the episodes about a parish there called Most Holy Redeemer, right in the heart of the Castro. And I interviewed about 10 people, and I think about 8 of them were brought to tears during the interview, just because this is a story for them that they haven't lived through viscerally in a couple decades. They kind of put it behind them. And to have someone coming to them and ask them to, you know, share these personal stories with them was not easy. So I was, you know, fortunate and honored to, you know, sit with them as they recounted these difficult times when, you know, a lot of their friends, partners were dying, and society seemed to shun them at the same time. So yeah, it is a heavy topic. And if you listen to the first episode of Plague, you know, you'll get some of that right away. But what I also enjoyed about these stories that I was reporting was there were moments of light too, and kind of moments of levity as well. I'm thinking of Christmas parties at Most Holy Redeemer, where I interviewed one guy who said, you know, it was really hard. It was a difficult time for me. But at this parish, I felt like I could be a human being again. And, you know, during the Christmas parties each year, which would get pretty wild, like they'd bring in professional chefs and they'd have music, drag shows, like in the church hall right there.
That's incredible. You know,
I got to feel like a human being again. And that I think is important too, because part of Catholicism, I think, is providing that joy that can sustain people even through difficult times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So Mike, in episode 1, you mentioned that part of what drew you to this project was trying to reconcile your own gay and Catholic identities. I'm curious though, like what drew you to look for that in a plague? Why look at a time of terrible suffering to try and understand a bit about your own self?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the answer I have is, in my mind, if I knew or thought of anything about the church during the AIDS crisis, it was kind of a combative relationship between gay activists and the Catholic hierarchy. Yeah. I think of things like ACT UP, big protests in New York between that group and Cardinal O'Connor, who was seen as kind of the institutional face of the church. So it was pretty combative, and, you know, it was kind of, you had good versus evil, kind of like that dynamic going on. But as I began to like look a little bit more into it, I saw that it was a lot more complicated than that, and that there were a number of gay activists who were also Catholic, so who kind of had a foot in both worlds. And I was curious how they handled this, because sometimes, you know, for us as we're reporting the news or living through it, you kind of start to think we're going through this for the first time, like how do we handle this? But then as you go through history, you start to learn that there were other people who have grappled with similar issues. And I think one of the challenges as gay Catholics is we don't really receive that history because the church isn't teaching it to us. And unless we are fortunate to befriend some older people who kind of have more life experience than us, who can share those lessons with us, we might not learn any of it. So when I began reaching out and noticing that there were a lot of LGBT people involved in the church and the gay rights movement in the 80s, that's when I really started learning that there was a lot here for me to understand. And I just had to make a phone call and have a conversation. And those conversations are what I hope people pick up on when they listen to Plague.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Do you feel like as the project progressed, did you have any success kind of learning to kind of unify those two worlds a bit that those folks who have gone before us have been able to do?
So a few people, I asked that question, a similar question to them. And I think the most repeated answer, I'm thinking of Cliff Morrison. He was a parishioner at Most Holy Redeemer who is responsible for setting up the AIDS ward at San Francisco General Hospital. He put it pretty succinctly. He said, look, you just have to claim your place in the church. You can't wait for anyone to give you approval. And that theme has kind of been the answer to people who have stuck it out, who were involved in AIDS ministry or just activism back in the 80s and 90s, who are still Catholic today. They said, if you wait for approval from church leaders, you're probably not going to get it. And you have to be okay with that and just claim your space. And I think that's probably true today, because a follow-up question I would often have is it better today? I mean, there's a lot more advancement and acceptance for LGBT people in society. Mm-hmm. The church people say that there's not as much. And I was curious, you know, was it easier back then, or is it better today? And a lot of them said it was actually easier back then, because it was almost as if the church was operating with a don't ask, don't tell policy. Whereas today it seems to be on the offense a little bit, kind of sometimes even seeking out LGBT people to kick them out of ministry. So but they said, you know, we chose to stick around. And I think young people have to make the same choice. If it's worth it to them and they think the church is an institution they want to belong to, they just have to take their space as a baptized Catholic.
That's pretty eye-opening. I feel like that's a common theme with queer people in general and minorities or people on the outskirts of having to make your mark or stand your ground. And I feel like we often have to have those people on the ground doing that for us and then people in the background also doing the work. But that's pretty beautiful.
Yeah, I think there's a nice episode, episode 4, I believe, where we learn about some of the allies. Unfortunately, because it's been so, 30 years now since the story happened, there was a group of old church ladies, as they put it to me, who really stepped up during the AIDS crisis and provided a ministry to the mostly gay men in the parish who were sick, many of whom were dying. And it was sort of this unlikely alliance that the pastor at the time was just really heartened by. So there are, it is important, people on the margins can't be expected to do it on their own. There is an important mm-hmm. role for allies here. And that's one of the lessons I learned too, is that there are good people who did step up, even if they're kind of away from the spotlight a little bit.
Right.
So Michael, as a young gay man, what was your perception of the AIDS crisis, either growing up or kind of as you became more comfortable with your queerness or being gay?
I don't remember much of it, is the honest answer. So I was born in 1985, mm-hmm. 34 now. So the peak of the AIDS crisis is generally accepted to be about 1995, 1996. So I was 10 or 11. I don't remember much of it firsthand. And I would say that if I thought of it at all, it was just through a lens of ignorance, I guess. I knew it happened. I knew a lot of people got sick. A lot of people died from AIDS-related complications. One stat that really sticks out to me is by the height of it, more than 300,000 Americans had died, which, as I say in the podcast, is equivalent to the entire population of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And that was shocking to me. I remember when I jotted that down to know, I guess, and when I went back to it to work on the script, I was convinced that I had wrote it down incorrectly and I had to go back and double check. Mm-hmm. So just the sheer magnitude of how many people were affected, that has stuck with me. And then also, I think it's important to remember that this is an ongoing mm-hmm. public health battle.
Definitely.
Both in this country, we're seeing sort of a resurgence of HIV in rural areas, among communities of color, mm-hmm. Where healthcare access has not always been as available, and especially in the developing world. So this is not, it's a history that I'm learning, but it's also a history that makes the present come alive in a new kind of more urgent way.
Yeah, when you were experiencing that, in episode 2, I remember you mentioned that you went to visit St. Vincent's Hospital, which was like this instrumental place in the AIDS community as far as the response in New York City. And you described it as being surprisingly emotional for you. Why was that? And kind of what struck out to you when you were there?
So St. Vincent's Hospital was in Greenwich Village, kind of the heart of gay New York at the time in the 80s and 90s. And back in the 90s, it kind of became synonymous with AIDS care. Its geographic location meant that it just had a large population to serve. But also the hospital made it a priority to serve marginalized communities. And this, at the time, meant gay men. It meant drug users. It meant people who couldn't afford access to, top health care. And it really became known for its compassionate care to people with HIV and AIDS. Unfortunately, the hospital shut down in 2010. So it's no longer there today, but Eloise Blondio, who produced the series with me, she and I decided that we would take a trek down there just to see what's still around. And as I described in the podcast, there's still some visible markers that there was a hospital there. Almost all the buildings have been turned into luxury condos now, but you can still see some of the signs. There's a small memorial across the street from one of the old buildings that's dedicated to people who died from AIDS and the Sisters of Charity of New York who ran the hospital. And I found it moving for a couple of reasons. First, it was just thinking of the number of gay men early on who died from this illness, died isolated and afraid, often rejected by their families. And so it was hallowed ground in some way. As a Catholic, we take sacramentality seriously, and place is a serious business to us. And it was just a little jarring to see very expensive condos built in a place where so many men spent their last days. That was moving to me. And secondly, we had read a lot of stories and met with some people who told us how early on, this is true of hospitals generally, but also at St. Vincent's before they made an effort to change. Early on, there were a lot of cases where men would get sick and they'd be admitted to the hospital. And because of the laws at the time, they would often have no rights to see their partners, or their partners would have no rights to see them. And that could mean, you know, dying alone, or it could mean a family kind of flying in from somewhere else and having a right to see you, even if they don't have your best interests at heart. And I was just thinking about how that scene had played out in this place. And that was kind of upsetting to think about. Like I said, these are heavy stories, but I think it's important that we remember them before we lose the people who were there.
So on your journey of interviewing a lot of people and hearing everyone's stories, was there anyone you met, or is there anything that you learned that really sticks with you? Are you still in touch with anybody that you've met along the way?
Yeah, I interviewed, I think we said we're close to 100 interviews for this project. It's been going on for,
that's incredible. Man.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, you only get a fraction of that in the podcast, but there were so many people who were so generous with their time and their stories. And, you know, even knowing that, you know, the couple of hours they would spend with us wouldn't make it into the podcast provided really good background for us. Just so many people were so helpful in the making of this production. But yeah, I'm still in touch with quite a few people. In episode 3, you'll hear a profile of a priest named Father William Hart McNichols. He's known today as an iconographer and artist. He draws icons that are in churches all over the world. But early on in his career, he did AIDS ministry in New York. He was a young Jesuit and kind of threw himself into that world and saw hundreds of patients over a 7-year span as a volunteer at St. Vincent's, but then also had his own ministry on the side. And his story is just, it's really interesting to see the crisis from the perspective of an openly gay priest. He was 33 at the time when he started that ministry. So the guys he was visiting, you know, were his age or younger. And to see like the toll it took on his own vocation and how he kind of dealt with that. He and I are still in touch. He is feeling good about this project. He said something that stuck with me. He came out in the 80s. Late 80s, early 90s, which was sort of a novel thing for a Catholic priest to do. And he faced some backlash. He said he found it interesting that even though he's in his 70s and he's been out publicly for decades now, they still is a little fear every time he does so. And he said that, you know, as a gay man, you're constantly being asked to come out whenever you tell the truth about yourself to anyone. So even though he's kept doing it over and over again, he was a little nervous about the podcast because he'd be identified as a gay priest again. So that stuck with me because there's some truth to that, I think, that LGBT people, there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of disclosing the truth about yourself. And that was a lesson that I hadn't thought about quite that way, that coming out is not a one-time thing. It's sort of a daily thing for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Like one thing that really stood out to me from the first episode was Cardinal John O'Connor, the Archbishop of New York City when the AIDS crisis hit, and who, you know, I guess was never really considered a friend of the gay community in a lot of ways, but he was doing a lot of work kind of in secret at St. Vincent's Hospital. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Cardinal John O'Connor, he was a former Navy admiral. He was kind of handpicked by Pope John Paul II to lead the Archdiocese in New York. We had a couple Catholic sisters describe him as like the most conservative archbishop in the country at the time. Also politically very powerful. This is at a time, I kind of joke that it's hard to believe, but at one time the Catholic Church in New York was a hugely powerful political institution. And, you know, he could like kind of make or break legislation. He was friends with the mayor. He was appointed to President Ronald Reagan's AIDS Commission. He was just a powerful guy. And he used his political clout to fight gay rights bills at the time that city council was trying to pass. So he was not a friend of the LGBT community by any means. And that's kind of the story. Like, that's why you have groups like ACT UP who protest him at the cathedral. That's why he's kind of taken aim at by, you know, LGBT groups in the 80s and 90s. But what I found interesting was he kind of encapsulates the complexity of the time, especially around the church and the AIDS crisis, because he did devote a lot of church resources to Catholic hospitals and hospices and nursing homes for people with AIDS at a time when many hospitals refused to do so. And personally, he said himself in an interview that he visited more than 1,000 people with AIDS over the course of his time in New York. So it's kind of like the criticism that I heard from people who were in ACT UP was, yes, the church did respond when people contracted HIV and AIDS and were dying, but they wouldn't do anything to help them, you know, not get HIV. And that was the big criticism. So O'Connor, I think, is emblematic of this sort of tension that a lot of Catholics felt. They knew that there was a need, that there was a group in trouble, and they wanted to respond and help, but they were just unsure how to do so because the question of sexuality has not been easy for the church.
Yeah. Do you know when Cardinal O'Connor would go visit these 1,000 patients, did the folks that he was visiting, did they know, like, this is the cardinal in the city that has a lot of influence over the city's reaction to the AIDS crisis? Like, were they able to have real conversations with him about how his policies were and his positions were impacting their own lives?
Yeah, that's a good question. And if I think it's the first episode, if you listened, I asked a Catholic sister, Pascal Conforti, who worked in HIV and AIDS ministry back in the 80s and 90s. I asked her that question, and she kind of scolded me a little bit in a fun way. She pointed out, which is obvious in retrospect, but these were like very sick people he was visiting. Yeah. A lot of them would have not been up for a conversation like that. And she also said that the cardinal, he did not come in any sort of regalia. He was just dressed in a collar like any other priest. And I mean, if you think about it, if I think about it, I mean, if I were in a hospital and the priest came to visit, unless I'm really plugged into the church, I probably wouldn't know, like, if he's a bishop or if he's just an ordinary parish priest. And I get the sense that that was true of a lot of these interactions. People assumed he was a hospital chaplain. And I mean, there are some stories out there about how O'Connor befriended some men in their final days. But a lot of it, I think, is a bit apocryphal at this point. He certainly did direct church resources. We know that as a fact. He says he visited a lot of people. But beyond that, we really don't know much else.
So in episode 2, you looked at some of the protests that ACT UP staged at St. Vincent's Hospital. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened and why they targeted a Catholic institution like that, considering that they were taking care and caring for the sick?
Yeah, so ACT UP, it was a really, I mean, they would say themselves, it was a really radical sort of in-your-face protest group who looked at their community and saw people dying, getting sick without much concern from wider society. So they engaged in really kind of shocking tactics to get the media to notice them, to hopefully raise awareness. So they protested all kinds of institutions, Wall Street, pharmaceutical companies, political leaders. Their big protest would come against the Catholic Church in 1989 when they stormed St. Patrick's Cathedral and interrupted a mass. 100 people were arrested. But a couple of years before that, they actually took on St. Vincent's, which, like we said, was the Catholic hospital in New York that was sort of the main treatment center for many gay men with HIV and AIDS. And there was a lot of debate internally at ACT UP about whether they should do this, because they were still a little nervous about taking on the church, because like I said, it was a powerful institution that meant a lot to a lot of people, but also because this was a place where a lot of people they cared about were sick and dying and resting, and they didn't really want to disturb things. But what really set it off was there was several instances where gay men were going to St. Vincent's, and they felt like they were being discriminated against. In one instance, there was a guy who was brought there after sort of like a gay bashing crime, and he got to the hospital only to be treated badly again by security staff, by not so much medical staff, we heard, but there were some instances where doctors were, you know, kind of using slurs or making gay jokes. And so the group targets the hospital, and they kind of take over the emergency room one night. There's an instance where one of the protesters puts a couple of condoms onto a crucifix. And it kind of creates a lot of tension, obviously, between the Catholic sisters who run the hospital and the protesters. But what I found so powerful was the sisters, instead of getting angry and even considering pressing charges, which the security company wanted them to do, they decided to kind of take a step back and ask, you know, what would make a group of people do this? And they decided that they were, you know, obviously in pain and angry and hurt and afraid. And they actually scheduled a series of meetings between the activists and the Catholic sisters that resulted in the sisters saying, well, we need to do better then. If our community doesn't feel safe here, we need to change things. So they implemented a series of reforms and asked staff to go through sensitivity training and work with the gay community to make it kind of the iconic place that it became for the LGBT community in New York. So it's an instance where you have church leaders, in this case, Catholic sisters, kind of examining their own actions, saying, how can we do better?
That's a pretty extraordinary response that they had. I'm curious, Mike, like you've studied the Catholic Church for a long time, especially here in the United States. Like, do you feel in general that a lot of ACT UP's tactics towards the Catholic Church, were they all in all effective? I know you mentioned in that episode that like it was kind of effective. The sisters did become a little more reflective, and the hospital in general became more reflective about how it can better serve this community. But in general, do you feel like some of those more inflammatory tactics are well received by the church, whether or not they want those type of protests? But does it actually spur the kind of results that they're hoping for?
So I need to give one caveat here, which I give in the series too, but I'm not an historian, right? So I'm kind of doing an oral history project to people and recounting their issues and their stories. And I'm really fortunate to get to do that. When it comes to the protests, I think there's still a big debate about whether these tactics were effective. With this incident at St. Vincent's, I think it's safe to say it was effective because we have people on both sides of it saying that it was. So, I mean, I'm comfortable to say, yeah, it kind of made the hospital realize they had to change some things. The big controversial protest, which you hear about in the first episode, the one at St. Patrick's, that's the one that I think history is still kind of considering, was it effective or not? It's actually the 30th anniversary this month of that protest. And the big controversy in that, besides disrupting a religious service, which is not a small controversy by any means, but one of the protesters ended up desecrating the Eucharist. He was Catholic and he took the host and kind of crumbled it on the ground. And that kind of turned public opinion against ACT UP, which was already seen as kind of a radical group. So I don't know. In addition to ACT UP, you had groups like Dignity, which was started 50 years ago for LGBT Catholics. And they were kind of that group that was caught in the middle, like I was saying. Like they were gay, but they were also Catholic, and they were trying to figure out a way for them to fit into the church. They did their own protests that were a little less in your face than ACT UP. But they still wanted to, you know, make it known that they didn't feel fully welcome in the institution. They ended up getting kicked out of the Catholic parishes where they worshiped in the 1980s. And I don't know if they were effective. Some members, you know, ended up leaving groups like that and just kind of finding a gay-friendly parish. Others are still very much active in Dignity, which is still, you know, still around today. And I think they're still trying to figure out, you know, what is the best way to get church leaders to notice us, and then also to, you know, carve out a place for them where they feel welcome and comfortable. So it's very much an ongoing struggle, I think, not something that it's just kind of cast to history.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess like, was there anything that you heard in this research that kind of helped bolster your own, you know, identity as a gay man? And was there anything that like gave you a little more faith in your church as well?
Yeah, I think it would go back to that sort of the insight that several people had that you just have to kind of claim your own space in the church. Whether you're LGBT, whether you're just not part of kind of historically what's been the Catholic Church in this country. If you feel like an outsider, you just have to kind of, unfortunately, you know, keep showing up and keep claiming your own space. And that was something that I have felt comfortable. I've been fortunate to find Catholic spaces that have welcomed me and where I can feel like I can be myself. And I, you know, through my reporting have obviously realized that that's not true for many LGBT Catholics, but I'm hoping that some of these stories will help them realize there are people who are, you know, working alongside them to make this space more welcoming.
many cultures who go through some kind of traumatic experience, like they have a way of passing down those stories so that it will be remembered. And hopefully, you know, there will be a sense of learning from it, that shared history. But the gay community, you mentioned this earlier, has kind of largely moved on in this country from the AIDS crisis, and our generation doesn't know a whole lot about what happened. Like we missed the worst of it, and due to, you know, some scientific advancements and just changes, like we don't know a whole lot about what happened. So I'm curious, like, what do you hope that our generation of gays kind of takes away from this podcast if they're listening?
That's a great question. I mean, for some reason, as I'm thinking about how to answer it, I'm thinking of a guy I interviewed named Tom Battipaglia. He lives in San Francisco. And he met up with me one afternoon. He was giving me a tour of the Castro, just to kind of set the scene for this episode about Most Holy Redeemer. And I asked him, you know, what was it like back before AIDS and after AIDS? And he said before AIDS, you know, he was just a lot of fun. He had moved there. I became a bartender, just met a lot of friends, and was like really having a good time and just like felt safe for the first time in his life. He said as the crisis got worse, he said all his friends died, that he just lost everyone. And I can't imagine what that's like. I've been fortunate that I've not had to, you know, bury any friends. I'm 34. I think that's the way it probably should be, right? But right. I did have a friend get very sick, and it was touch and go for a while, and that was dramatic enough. I can't imagine what it would have been like to lose, you know, we're talking like a generation of gay men in this country. And I think the best way to honor them is to remember their stories. And that's why we went out of our way to make sure we talked to people who lost friends and partners during that time, so that they could share their stories with us. Because I think there is a lot to learn about what these people, what their lives were like, what they went through, and, you know, kind of insight that they share with us. So my hope is that people who maybe aren't acquainted with LGBT people who are a little bit older than them, that they might kind of meet them through this podcast and listen to what they have to say.
Speaking of the older generations of our the gay community in the church, they are typically the ones that I see on the front, in the front pews every Sunday.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful and a sight to see when I see them so faithful, and they're doing the work.
And showing up.
And showing up, yeah. And I think in your first episode, the guy that you had interviewed who lost his partner, he started out in the back of the church out of fear of where his place was in the church. And then now, as years have gone by, he's there every Sunday in the front pew.
Yeah, that was a really powerful visual image for me. And I think you make a good point that we see people in the front, and it would be easy to think that like that's just the way it is. But especially in David's story, you know now that it took a lot for him to get up there.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
Everyone sitting in the front pew, if you're an LGBT Catholic today and you chose to stay in the institution, you have your own story about how you ended up there. So just like being aware of that and taking time to listen to those stories when you're fortunate enough to have an opportunity to, I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the church can learn from its response to the AIDS crisis as it wrestles with queer people in society today?
I think listening is hugely important. And in the instances where the church responded positively to the need back in the 80s and 90s, it always started with listening, whether it was St. Vincent's, where the Catholic sisters listened to the protesters, or Most Holy Redeemer, where the pastor made it a point to listen to the gay community. There's always the sense that we have to learn before we can teach. And I think that that's often an element in society today, generally. This willingness to acknowledge that I don't know something and I need to listen to someone else is one that's often missing.
Mike, you've done an incredible amount of research in this project. Do you have any plans for it beyond the podcast, maybe a book or anything like that?
Yeah, I hope lots of people listen. I know you guys have a great community, and I'm appreciative of being on here. If people download the podcast, subscribe to it, tell friends, leave a review. It helps other people come across the content. And then after that, I'm going to keep researching. I've been fortunate that people are reaching out and sharing stories with me that I haven't heard yet. And fingers crossed, hopefully there'll be some sort of book project in the not too distant future.
All right. We will definitely be keeping that in our prayers then, because we hope so.
Do you, beyond a book or beyond the AIDS topic, do you have any other topics that relate to the queer community, the gay community, and the church's relationship with them that you're planning to focus on? Or
I've been telling people when they ask me, you know, what's going on in the news these days, I say I've been living in the 1980s and 90s for like the last year, so I have no information. So we're kind of crossing a finish line right now, so I'm going to sit with this for a while and then take a little break, hopefully, and get back into whatever's next. So
definitely
right now,
well-deserved.
No plans.
Mike, thank you so much for taking the time and storytelling around the AIDS crisis and everything you're doing for the church and the community, and for spending time with us. Tell everyone where they can find your podcast and your work.
Sure. People can visit americamedia.org/plague. All the episodes will be uploaded there. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. And I would just encourage you to subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends.
Awesome. Michael Laughlin, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, guys.
So, Jacob, what are we toasting this week?
This week, I'm toasting Max, a Vine and Fig community member. Max is reaching a new milestone in his transition. He's recently started testosterone, and although being on testosterone is a measurable thing, the transition isn't. Your journey is much bigger than changing your external appearance as a trans person, and you've been a strong and active member of this community. One of the first, actually.
Yeah, one of the very first.
Yeah, and I just want to give you a big toast.
Cheers to Max.
Cheers.
And I'm toasting actor Billy Dee Williams, who most of you will know from the Star Wars movies, but he opened up in an interview this week about being gender fluid and using both male and female pronouns, and she's 82, so I think that takes some incredible guts, really, at any age to come out about your pronouns, but good for him for not being afraid of the truth and talking about who he really is.
And 82... and being gender fluid.
Yeah.
This is not a millennial phenomenon, as
Absolutely.
Most people are saying. So, yeah. I mean, that's...
This is a thing that, like, it has been a reality for all her life. And so, like, that's awesome for being willing to share that with all of us, because it helps everybody, no matter your age.
Cheers, Billy Dee Williams.
Cheers to Max and Billy Dee Williams. All right, y'all, that is it for us. A big, sincere thank you to Michael O'Loughlin and everyone who shared stories with him and Eloise over the past few years. You can support both our podcasts by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can support Tabard In on Patreon at patreon.com/vineandfigco. And if you are a queer Catholic looking for some community, head on over to our website, and you can join us in our private Slack room to meet some queer Catholics around the world. Thanks for listening, y'all. Bye.
Bye.